podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Ajit. In today's episode, we have a really special guest whom I've been meaning to invite on this show for a while. I like his style of writing and I expect he'll be a very good guest. But before we go there, I would like to remember fondly one of our former co-hosts. He's been on this podcast multiple times as a guest co-host, and I got to know recently that he has passed away. So I'm talking of Ravi Nair from the Guerrilla Verse. So those of us who listen to Guerrilla Cricket or have been involved with Guerrilla Cricket will probably already know this very well. So Ravi Nair, who lived in India and was a very vibrant part of the Guerrilla Verse, is no more. And I would like to take a moment to just remember him. So our discussions have always been fun. He's come on this on the podcast multiple times, as I said, and we all know his love of animals, especially his cat. And also a very vibrant man, and more importantly, a very forthright man when it came to his thoughts on cricket and how it was being played and how it was run. We will miss him, and our thoughts are with his family and friends. And wherever he may his soul rest in peace. All right, on to the new guest that we have. He's Tom, but he writes a very specific blog, Rain Stopped Play Inspection at 3. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Nice to meet you, Ajit.
So let's start right at the interesting name you have for your blog, Rain Stopped Play Inspection at 3. It sounds very innocuous, but why such a long name?
Well, it's I suppose it sums up a bit English cricket. It's always raining here. We spend a lot of time as cricket lovers looking at damp outfields, waiting for the umpires to wander along. And sometimes you hear that announcement over the tannoy at the grounds. Obviously, the rain stop play. There'll be an inspection at 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock, whatever it may be. So it was just to sum up that sort of approach that all cricket lovers know. There's a lot of frustration involved.
Yes. So what with, you know, at least in the English summer, there's a lot of rain and a lot of cricket, well, both simultaneously. So it's a part of a cricketing life in England. I mean, there are even bad jokes like somebody from other parts of the world thought this is a ritual to get rain and so on. So that's a very famous joke from a different era. But nonetheless, interesting. And I also see that, you know, you've come back to start writing again, you say, or you've rediscovered the love. So why did the love go away? Let's start. When did the love form first?
Yeah. So when I was young, I guess at the age of around sort of 10, 11, 12, I started to develop an interest in cricket without really understanding what was going on. My father wasn't particularly keen, but crucially, I had some school friends that knew a little bit about cricket. So we gradually, in those days, you'd have television, sort of free-to-air television to watch cricket in England. Sadly, it's very rare to have that these days. So I started to watch John Player League, which was Sunday afternoon, 40 over cricket. And then one of my friends said, actually, why don't we go along to see Gloucestershire, our local county team. I live in Bristol in England. And so we'd go along there as young lads and spend our summer holidays watching Gloucestershire play cricket. Quite often losing, although actually, in fairness, they weren't a bad side there. I very quickly realised I was a terrible cricketer myself, but I enjoyed, hopeless. I'd sort of chap who would bat number 9 or 10, bowl at maybe 7th or 8th change and field at third man. You get the drift of how good I was. But I just love the atmosphere of watching cricket. I'm no expert on cricket, but I love the conversations that you have with people when you're watching the game. Those moments when the excitement becomes really intense and the energy around it is fabulous. But when I suppose I used to watch cricket up until the age of about sort of 16, 17, 18, no, a bit eight, maybe into my early 20s. Then I got married and life just got in the way, really. My wife didn't stop me going to cricket, but cricket takes a lot of time, as we all know. And other things became more pressing. So for many years, I didn't really go to watch. I'd see the occasional game. And then, joy of joys, I became old enough to retire a little early. So I retired when I was 60. And suddenly, I have a lot of free time on my hands. Luckily, I live about 15 minutes walk from the county ground, as it was known here in Bristol, now called the Seat Unique Stadium, where Gloucestershire play their home games, and Western Storm, that the ladies team play occasionally as well. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, let's get a membership again so I can go along to every form of cricket at the county ground and sit with my mates, many of whom I was sitting with back in the 1980s. And wow. So rekindling old friendships as well as rekindling a love of the game.
Perfect. And I suppose you started writing to accompany your love as well. Watching it.
That's right. Yeah. I've over recent years, I've dabbled with various bits of writing, personal blogs, and then also things about music and food and travel, but never really written about cricket. I have written about football for a fanzine. I'm a Bristol City supporter for my sins, another very unsuccessful team. So I occasionally write for a football fanzine, but I'd never written about cricket. And again, the benefit of time through being retired, I thought I'd like to just capture my feelings of going back to watch it, hopefully with some humour. I don't take it terribly seriously. I think few people do with a county game. It's a lovely spirit is the main thing. And I wanted to try and write about that aspect of cricket as much as the nuts and bolts of winning, losing and averages.
Interesting outtake. And of course, look, I think it's a tale as old as not time, but cricket itself, that men want to play cricket and the wives have other plans for them. And yeah. Of course, we see a lot of that. I play in the local leagues here in the Netherlands and right. I've been for a better part of a decade and more. And you see that, you know, a guy gets married, he loses that season because he's married. And then in a year or two, there is some good news. And then he loses that season because he has to stay home and take care of the baby.
Right. Yeah.
But that's a good thing that, you know, there was a time where I think Michael Vaughan said that his father was on the field the day he was born, or was on the field when he was born.
Yes.
There was a time when men were not really expected to do much more, but now it's a far more serious thing. And men have to also take a direct interest in the family well-being and, you know,
absolutely
up a family. And that's a good thing, right?
So, yes. All
right.
I
so
agree.
Now that you're, superannuated, is that the right term? And you have a lot of free time and you're able to... You're able to then indulge in your hobby, but that's how we met. So I'm happy to have made your acquaintance, and that's a nice story. It's a very idyllic pastime, especially if you're retired. I'm sure to sit and watch a game, but I see that you've written about the longest format. You've also written about the ODI Cup as well as the T20. So you've probably seen the game evolve, so having seen, you know, John Players League, whatnot. You said
yes,
right? So. Do you think cricket is going in the right direction with the 100? There are enough solid vocal supporters and or detractors, but as somebody who's seen it evolve, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a really interesting time in the game. And fun enough, I was at an event yesterday at the county ground. There's a brilliant thing that Gloucestershire put on called Walkers and Talkers, where Andy Brassington, a former Gloucestershire wicketkeeper, just hosts these events every week and people come along and chat, sometimes sporting, sometimes not. Yesterday, we had a guy called Don Topley, who famously didn't take a catch for England against the West Indies when he stood on the boundary rope when he was a substitute fielder. But fascinating man. And actually, he slightly changed my opinion of things. And I'll maybe explain why. So I'm quite traditional with cricket. County Championship cricket and Test Match cricket are my ideal forms of the game, I'd say. The John Player League, though, as a 40-over game, was my introduction. So I've got tolerance with that. And also 50-over and 60-over cricket. I was used to that when I was younger. And I quite enjoy those formats because they all give a reasonable time for some ebb and flow in the game. And that's, to me, the essence of the game, is that your team can be up on the ropes, in a terrible, you know, you're 23 for five, you're in all sorts of trouble. Somehow a pair dig in, you get a stand going, and then you bowl well, and you can still win a game. Right. The 20 over game is a bit, I'm not the biggest fan. And up until last season, I'd never seen a 20 over game, I'll be honest with you. I was very dismissive of it. I went along to watch all the Gloucestershire games at home last season, and I enjoyed them. They're a different essence of the game. You take it for what it is. But what I don't like is that those games could be decided rather too quickly. If someone gets off to a tremendous start, either batting or bowling, the game could be a little dead. Even more so, and I'll be honest with you again, I've not seen a game of the 100 at all. They don't have it here in Bristol. Some friends of mine have been over to Cardiff to see the Welsh Fire team, which features some Gloucestershire and Somerset players. I've tried watching a little bit on television when it is on the BBC. And I don't know, the way they do the graphics and the scores, I can't work out what's going on most of the time. And I do get bored with constant sixes and fours. They're a wonderful thing, and I think they should be a special entity. I don't like the plethora of boundaries, and I do feel sorry for those poor old bowlers, I must admit, who get carted all over the place. Obviously, their mentality is slightly different, and they go into games knowing what can happen. When they do succeed, obviously, it's doubly exciting for those players, I assume. So that's great. Mm. And I've been, as I say, very, very dismissive of the 100 as a concept. But just going back to what Don Topley said yesterday, the game in England, from his figures, and I've not been able to double check them, said the number of players playing the game, club cricket, you know, in local leagues, is diminished dramatically in this country in the past 10 years. There's no free-to-air television, so kids these days have to go out of their way to watch cricket. And with the best will in the world, the longer form of cricket can be quite an ordeal for the younger person who can be easily distracted, shall we say, without being unkind to them. The 100 gives them a route into it, in maybe the same route that I had watching the John Player League. So 40 over cricket wasn't, after a short time, wasn't my favourite format, but it was the key that opened the door for me. So if the 100 can do that, then great. If it gets more young people involved in the game who wish to play, importantly, because we're going to need players in the future, and they seem to be diminishing in this country anyway, and indeed watch the game, that does serve the longevity of the game well, and we've got to try and protect that. I still don't see myself rocking along to a 100 game anytime soon, I'll be perfectly honest with you. But I hope that for some people it can be that entry level game that gets their interest. It's had a big impact. The fact there's no test matches in August, it seems nonsensical to most people in England, I think. That's when test cricket should be played, when people are on holiday, people have the time to watch games.
Right.
That's been taken away from them. And the Ashes series this season, both for men and women, were terrific contests. And we should have more opportunity to see that, I think, over the spread of the summer, rather than that condensed format. It also has a knock-on effect with the One Day Cup, which is now the Metrobank One Day Cup. I quite like what it's done to that. I mean, it's served Gloucestershire fairly well this season because a lot of the key players have taken off to play in the 100. They're taken away from their counties. It gives you the opportunity to see some younger players who are a bit earlier in the development of their career. And I think Gloucestershire have benefited from that, and a few other counties have as well, is that younger players get the chance to play in competitive games that do have a meaning and a purpose, in front of crowds, which sometimes could be quite large, not necessarily always. And I quite like that. And, you know, certainly here at Gloucestershire, we've seen this year, a lot of very young players playing and playing to a good level and actually playing an exciting form of cricket, you know, scoring runs quickly, taking wickets, bowling aggressively. The fielding, as we know, is improved beyond any compare with what I used to watch in the old days. So even though a lot of people in England moan about the 100 and the impact on the One Day Cup, I'll be honest, I quite like it. I quite like seeing young talent coming through. I'm always one that's looking for the, not necessarily the finished article. It's great to see a majestic player in, at the top of their game. I love the thrill of the promise of a young player and what they might become. And I love the opportunity to watch that develop in front of me.
That's always nice. But also what you said, it probably takes the younger generation a shorter attention seeking game. In your time, it was one players league, and now it is the 100. It's quite a lot of difference from 6 hours or 7 hours to quite a lot less. But all right, so it can happen. But nonetheless, that's the way forward is what I understand. And that's the way it can be is what also I understand. And that is always encouraging. That if it can win over somebody who's seen more of life and knows the finer things in life and still can actually come to appreciate what it can add, that means there's still some hope for that format. And look, we will look to reduce the amount of time we get to play simply because of people wanting to do many other things with the time.
Yeah.
And nobody can begrudge them that. And that's how it could be. So we are going to work it out. And that means a shorter format is not the worst format at all, simply because we want this game of ours that we love to be here. And I dare say the shorter formats will allow the longer formats to be played, that's attracting the crowds.
Yeah, absolutely. One has to feed the other, doesn't it? And if they can coincide, as they have done in the past, I suppose the problem these days has become more one of scheduling with the ability for players to play all over the world all year round these days. And that I do worry slightly about the strain that puts on players, you know, particularly bowlers. But when you're dropping off, you know, onto a plane, you're in India, you're in New Zealand, you're in Australia, you're back in England. And I just think we've got to be careful of the management of players' physical attributes, but also mental attributes as well. I think that's something that cricket's got to be really careful about.
No, I understand what you mean. Maybe there is such a thing as burnout due to overexposure or too much of stress. I mean, having to go out there and delivering day in, day out is not, you cannot expect that to be easy.
That's
you can imagine it can become very quickly overwhelming if one is not careful. So that's a good point. That's a good point you bring.
I listened actually to one of your previous podcasts, and one of your previous guests made a really good point. I think he was talking about how memorable certain games are, and he said he watched and wrote about a lot of cricket, a lot of one-day games and 20-over games and short-form games. And actually, when they're gone, he doesn't remember them quite quickly. They tend to fade from the memory. And I wonder if that's because there's too many of them, that the brain can only cope with so many major excitement points in your life, I think. And again, big moments have value when there's a rarity to them. If you have big moments every day, they stop becoming big moments. So again, cricket's got to manage that in some way, I feel.
I understand. I know what you mean because I've felt it with IPL, for example. Every game is such a thriller that the concept of what you would define as a thriller is broadening or shrinking depending on how you look at it, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So now let's have a quick chat about the plenty of games that have happened since the last episode. I think we are entering a very busy period of cricket leading up to the World Cup.
Yes.
So there have been multiple series, both men and women, that are currently undergoing or just finished, and we would want to discuss about them. So let's start with the Asia Cup. So the Super Fours have started, and recently Pakistan have beaten Bangladesh in what turned out to be a surprisingly one-sided game.
Yes.
But if we go a little before, I think there are a couple of games worth discussing. India's tough chase where they made it look easier than it could have been.
Yeah.
They won against Nepal because Nepal's bowling attack was not very experienced that way. First of all, the most anticipated match in the earlier part of the series, India-Pakistan got rained off. And I think more or less either team wanted to bat first if they had won the toss is what I heard. They knew it was going to be a one session game. The second one would go on. So why not get in your runs? And I thought the frailty of Indian top order versus people like Shaheen Shah, Naseem Shah and Haris Rauf, it came to the fore because these three took all the wickets on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Right? It's funny with Naseem Shah because we only had a glimpse of him at Gloucestershire. He came last summer and he was here at the start and sadly only played a couple of games. And he was terrific in the flesh, and he wasn't really bowling at full tilt there. And I've been interested to see how he's gone on and done well for Pakistan. I think he's a major threat. And with Harris Rowe as well, they're a real combination. I like the Pakistani bowling attack, the aggression and the skill. But being slightly parochial, although he didn't stay with us very long, I do love watching Nazim Shah. And he scored some useful runs on occasions when the pressure's been on as well, hasn't he? So he's a useful member of that team.
I think he won that game against Afghanistan. That was going to be a tight one, but he did what was needed in the last over to win it.
That's right.
On the other hand, I think Afghanistan, if we were to quickly go back to Afghanistan, I think they'll be a bit disappointed with their performance, because look, against Bangladesh, they considered a lot of runs. This is the earlier part when they were playing in Pakistan. And they considered a lot of runs, Mehdi Hasan scoring 100. He was promoted up the order. He was promoted to open. And he did a wonderful job. He did what was expected in order to try and maybe give their batting order some depth. He scored 100. And Nazmul Hasan Shant also scored 100. And there were some quick-fire cameos from the experienced hands. And 334 against Afghanistan, I don't think they have that sort of maturity yet to chase it down.
No, that's right. Yeah, it's a big total, isn't it? Mm.
I mean, at least in this game, they didn't get the start they wanted. Rahmanullah Gurbaz, you want somebody like him to go after the bowling in the first power play. Already set the tone, right? He failed. But then the rest of the sort of longer format players, people like Ibrahim Zadran, Rahmat Shah, Hashmatullah Shahidi, these are all people who like the longer formats. They like you know, the ODIs, they like the tests, and they like to spend time, and they did that. But then, you know, Bangladesh eventually had enough on the board that they ran away after that start, where their fast bowling, Taskeen Ahmad, Shorifull Islam, and the likes, they did enough. And the middle order punch did not come through, even though Bangladesh were able to set up, Afghanistan were able to set up a platform. The likes of Najibullah Zadran, Nabi, Gulbadin Naib, and Karim Janath, the people who are supposed to score some quick fire runs, they couldn't do that.
They couldn't up the tempo, could they? So, yeah, that's right.
But then from there to see Afghanistan, the way they tried and nearly succeeded against Sri Lanka, that was quite a scare, if you are right. So they, first of all, you know, could not do as well with the ball. They ended up conceding 291 to Sri Lanka. And I think Kusal Mendes, who's one of the more brighter talents out there, frankly, it's between him and his temperament, really. He managed to, for once, harness that and got Sri Lanka to 291 in what is effectively like a 35-over shootout if you're a Afghani batter, right?
Yeah.
There as well, they didn't get going much. Gulbadin Naib was promoted to number 3, but something miraculous happened because everybody, Rahmat Shah, Hashmatullah Shahidi, played their hand, but then Mohammad Nabi played a blinder, scoring at 200. Karim Janat did what was required. Najibullah Sadran, who was, you know, who held back, did his bit. And then Rashid Khan hit 3 boundaries in an over to get them a chance of 3 of 1 ball.
Yeah.
Right? And unfortunately, it was Mujibur Rahman facing that ball. And he tamely hit it to mid-on and was out.
I did see that. And having that's the great anxiety of those games when you pull yourself back into it and then at the death. I mean, he did his very best in the Aussie, but it was very disappointing. But what a scare for Sri Lanka, like you say.
But then when you look at it, I mean, they complained they did not get given the full information or the full impact of what could have happened. That is,
with the run rate. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. What if he had taken a single off that one ball? Then if Rashid Khan had hit a boundary shot, a 4 or a 6, they would have won the game, but still finished that marginally, whatever, third decimal point ahead of Sri Lanka. Right?
That's right.
They told, at least the coach of Afghanistan, Jonathan Trott, said they were not given the full extent of it. I think it's very simple that it's a communication error, but also I think it's a fault that lies with both parties, where you have to also understand how the system works, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I must be, as a fan, sometimes I struggle with these things, but the people actually running the teams and running the nation should know what's going on. With the help of the officials, obviously the match officials at the time, but that was a particularly curious one. And for someone like Jonathan Trott, who's obviously very experienced in the game, to admit he didn't understand what was happening was quite an eye-opener for me, certainly.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, there are nuances, right? So we are used to, as cricketers, thinking of this is the target we need to achieve, this is the number of balls left, And yeah. Once you achieve the target, you can walk off in theory. Or you fail to achieve the target, you stop the game, right?
Yeah.
But then, no, it happened in our league game this season where due to rain shortening, 18 overs was the target setup. And this was the target, 89 in this case was the target. So our team achieved that with two balls left. But then when everybody started walking off, the umpire had the common sense to say, guys, wait. Right. In the remaining two balls, if you take a wicket, they'll have to score two more runs. You'll win. Right? Because that's how Duckworth Lewis works. So you set up a game of 18 overs.
You have to see it through.
You have to see it through. So this is the failing there. And I was a bit surprised at how inept Fazl Haq Farooqi ended up. He didn't look like he would survive even a single ball. De Silva, very, very experienced, Dhananjay De Silva, did what was needed.
Yes.
And he clinched the victory for Sri Lanka. I think Afghanistan did not deserve to lose that game. But then the way it transpired, they lost that game.
Tough one to say that.
Nepal knew they were like also rans as far as this tournament went, and they would be happy to, you know, get as much game time against the top sides in Asia as possible. That was fine. So they probably went home not as satisfied, but not fully disappointed. But then when it comes to a team like Afghanistan, who have come such a long way that we consider them equal to Bangladesh and sometimes even one step above on a certain day with Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, we don't know, right? Because they can surprise anybody in Asia.
Absolutely.
Everybody in the world, but mainly in Asian conditions where the spinners are coming to the fore, their way of playing cricket. They still play sort of late 1990s sort of cricket where they take it slow, they start off slow, and then they hit out towards the end to cross 270, 280, and their bowlers will choke you sort of with a lot of spin. You see that, you know, they would probably feel really let down because the end result of how many games they won is not the correct reflection of how they played.
It's true, but they have to view that as a learning point, first of all, but then take it as encouragement for how close they came, and that they can build, hopefully, and become stronger and stronger as tournaments go forward for them.
Right. From then on, we move on to the Super Fours, where the first game happened yesterday, and Haris Rao seems to have now... He took 50 ODI wickets yesterday with some of his dismissals, but also, I mean, everybody's eyes is on... Everybody would be looking at Shaheen Shah Afridi and Naseem Shah.
Yeah.
But Haris Rao, probably in the shortest format, he has more eyes on him. But then the longer the format, maybe not, we think. But he was the star turn, 4 for 19 in that game. Because, look, first of all, Bangladesh will be really disappointed that they looked comfortable. Litton Das looked comfortable. Mohammad Naeem looked comfortable. And then suddenly, something went wrong. In as much that they lost the wicket of Miraz very early on, first ball. Right? Then... Tauhid Hriday also got out very early. It fell back on the two experienced campaigners, Shakib Al Hasan and Mushfiqur Rahim. So from 4 for 47 under the 10 over mark, you know you're going to be chasing the game the rest of the way.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And Pakistan has enough depth with their bowling. You saw that. So you saw, they had three standard seamers or three frontline seamers and a bowling all rounder in Fahim Ashraf. And three other bowling all-round spinners. Like you had Shadab Khan, who will be your trump card spinner. But then you have Aga Salman, who went for a few runs. They immediately went back to Iftikhar Ahmed. You forget how experienced a cricketer Iftikhar Ahmed is. Because his dismissal of Shamim Hossain, I thought, was a turning point in the second half of Bangladesh batting. So, Shakib Al Hasan had did his bit. Mushfiqur Rahim and Shamim Hossain were batting well. Then you thought, if these guys can take Bangladesh beyond the 45-hour mark, take them to, I don't know, 228... From there, Bangladesh can make 260. That suddenly becomes a very interesting score. Right?
That was a key partnership, wasn't it? That was developing, yes.
But then Iftikhar worked Shamim Hossain out. He saw this guy has a big ego. He wants to hit the ball far.
Yeah.
He kept him quiet for two balls. And the next ball, Shamim ends up skying, which is taken. And then you have the other youngster, Afif Hossain, who, again, has a lot of promise. Right? He's the guy, even if he hits 30, he'll hit it in like 20 balls.
Yeah.
So the point is, can he bat 20 balls? That's the point about this guy.
what did he do? 11 yesterday, wasn't it? Yeah.
11 balls, 12 runs. I won six
exactly.
In that.
Yeah.
So, but then, amidst all this, we saw Mushfiqur Rahim attempt something really silly. Charge Haris Rao trying to hit him over extra cover and get caught behind.
Yeah. So
that left a lot to be desired for me. I think they lost their last four wickets for four runs or five runs.
Yeah.
That's terrible because... In today's day and age where we know even number 11 can sort of bat, you know, can hold up one end. you're expected to make 10 runs per partnership.
Yeah. Right? That's right. They were 190 for six, I think, weren't they? And then 193 all night. Yeah, crazy.
That's terrible. So
yeah,
from that point on, you know, you have let yourself down. And then the variety in Pakistan's attack, this is one of the most heartening things if you're a Pakistan cricket fan.
Mm.
These three or four all-rounders, Fahim Ashraf, Shadab Khan, Aga Salman, Iftikhar Ahmed, these are the same four you can invert around and that will come after number four or five in the batting lineup.
Yeah.
They give you a lot of depth and that's fantastic if you're a Pakistan team. So in a chase like this, you have nothing to worry.
Mm.
Imamul Haq has shown a lot of maturity these days, I think. He's finishing off these chases. He's able to take his time because he knows going at five and over is never going to be an issue for him.
Yeah.
And he keeps doing it knowing the confidence he has is knowing the likes of Aga Salman, Iftikhar Ahmed, Shadab Khan, same guys, and sometimes on his day, Mohammad Rizwan and Babar Azam. They can also pick up the scoring.
And Rizwan did well, didn't they, in this one? Yes, right? That's right. Yeah. So I dare say,
in helpful conditions, Pakistan will be a handful, for sure.
But even
come the World Cup, they're still playing air courts nearly at home. It's exactly what they're used to, isn't it?
Yes.
I think for once Pakistan is able to alloy some sort of consistency in their thought process and approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very, very dangerous Pakistan team. I don't know if you think the same way.
Yeah. All round strength. Like you say, they've got experience. They know what they're doing, but they've got such a depth with the all rounders, genuine pace as well. Batsmen who can score runs. They're on their day. They can beat absolutely anybody, can't they? There's no question about that. And they've got good experience. So major threat going forward, definitely.
Right. So when it comes to quickly about Bangladesh, I mean, they'll be again very disappointed. I mean, even more than Afghanistan, I think Bangladesh should be the real disappointed team because they don't seem to be learning because the youngsters who come into the team like a flashy 20 more than a 30 ball 27 or something.
Yeah.
Which mostly we knew the games. Or which mostly set you up in a position where you can try and win.
Yeah.
And we discuss later on. Yeah.
It seems to come down to that discipline aspect. And they don't seem to, as an individual, grasp that within their role within a team sport. There does seem to be a little bit too much ego at play sometimes, it seems to me, for the one person who wants to be the hero rather than playing a role for the team.
I mean, Shamim Hossain is a really new entity and he's very exciting, but look, Afif has played 30 ODIs and 63 T20Is. That's nearly 100 games at the top level. And you expect no hundreds yet, right? You expect him to have cracked it at some point in time because he's very exciting.
Yes.
But then you need to show that promise where sometimes you have to make that hard graft 38 of 45, right?
And
then your team will benefit. You would think a slowly scored 230 is better than haphazard 193 on such pitch.
They
have a while to go because even their fast bowling attack is sometimes hit and miss.
Can be erratic, right?
So Taskeen Ahmed has been more or less good. Shorifull Islam is all right, but then you don't see Mustafizur Rahman as a steady starter now anymore. The guy who came up with those cutters, who literally buried India by taking back-to-back 5-4s and so on, he's lost his edge a little bit. Hasan Mahmood is a backup who can also bat a bit, we know. People like this need to step up. Also, there are many other names like that. So, it's a tough call. Litton Das, who's sort of, again, Mehdi Hasan Miraz is sort of doing okay. I don't want to sort of tick him up. But people like Mohammad Naeem, Litton Das, you expect these guys to step out and win games outright by themselves with the bat.
How do you think that they'll do against Sri Lanka then? With Sri Lanka have that scare against Afghanistan. Do you think that would have given Bangladesh a bit of hope about the way to play them?
Look, Sri Lanka, again, they're playing at home, right? So if you look at tomorrow's game, you would expect Sri Lanka to actually win, but not comfortably.
Right, yeah.
Because, again, pin bowling attack of Sri Lanka. So they always open with Mahesh Tikshana. You have the fast bowling attack of Mathisha Pathirana. And Kasun Rajit has been doing very well.
Yeah.
You have their fast bowlers, but also their spinners. What you see is some maverick performance from Dhananjay De Silva, Charita Salanka, and then Kushal Mendes. The captain has been quiet, Dasun Shanaka. I expect they'll pull through. You see a new hunger in the likes of Sadhira Samaravikrama, and Kushal Parera has not got an opportunity yet. He's back in the squad. Pathum Disanka and Dimuth Karunaratne are pretty steady right at the top. You have enough there. Let me put it like this, that can they dig deep when they need to? Probably Sri Lanka can. Ahead of Bangladesh, Sri Lanka will be able to do that better. That's what I'm thinking.
Should be able to. Yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah. Interesting game, though, in prospect. Definitely.
Definitely. So also, if you look at the table, if you look at the bigger picture and look at the table of where the teams are, I think both teams will want to win this. So you don't want to take anything for granted, because in the Super Four, currently only Pakistan and Bangladesh have played a game. But you know, with both of these teams expecting to play, Bangladesh will play India, but then Sri Lanka will play both India and Bangladesh, India and Pakistan. So, you know, those will be the tough games. So you want to win this one.
So absolutely. Yeah,
it's going to be a winner plays, winner takes all sort of a competition. Bangladesh, if they lose that game, they're done. They don't need to worry about it. So they have to win it.
Yeah, that's right. So they got to go. So that's where the maturity aspect comes into it. When you know you're in a must-win game, but you've got to play with discipline to win that game. That's their test, I think.
Let's see if they're able to muster up that certain amount of maturity on both sides, frankly. But it'll be an exciting game. You're right.
Yes, yeah.
So
should be.
Before we go away from this section, who do you back to win the Asia Cup, Tom?
I think Pakistan, because of their bowling attack. I really like the Pakistani. I mean, you can never discount India. Fantastic players, and I'm used to winning games in pressure situations. But I just think the Pakistani bowling attack, for me, would just have the edge on it.
Absolutely, you're right. So for me, the outright favourites are Pakistan. But the India, right? So as you say, you cannot write them off. Or Sri Lanka at home, you don't know. The point is, Sri Lanka won an Asia Cup previously. Just one last year, if I'm not wrong. But if you think of India, they have a hoodoo that they are not unable to win multi-team tournaments in the last 4 to 5 years. They are always bridesmaid, so on, semi-finalists.
True.
So they look to overturn it somewhere. You cannot expect that the World Cup will sort of fall into your lap simply because you're playing at home.
No.
You'll need to start that preparation of mental fortitude also here, right here. You play against Pakistan, you try and win those games, tight ones, right?
No, definitely.
So maybe also, you know, it's sort of a last hurrah for many players in that Indian team. So you may expect they may want to go away with a, you know, happy sort of a walk into the sunset rather than a hunched shoulder walk. So we don't.
The other factor as well is the weather, isn't it? We just got to hope we don't get any more fair weather interruptions, because that's just be so frustrating if that has a deciding influence on things.
Now, we keep seeing these memes all over the Twitter where it's raining, it's like all like puddles up to the ankles in the streets of Sri Lanka and so on. So we don't know how much of an impact that'll have, but if you're a fan, you just want a good game, even if it's a shortened one, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Now, if we were to quickly move on to the South Africa-Australia series, well, the T20I series ended very interestingly, where Australia blanked South Africa. So usually, Australia-South Africa is always needle contests where the away team does well, by and large, except for limited overs competitions, where I saw that before today's ODI, Australia had lost their last 8 ODIs to South Africa at home. But now,
I didn't realize it was that many. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So now, under Mitchell Marsh, something seems to have changed. And they don't have all their number one choice players. Huh? They don't have Pyramids. They don't have Mitchell Stark. They have a bunch of good bowlers. So when you look at the T20s, they had Spencer Johnson, Nathan Ellis, Tanvir Sangha, right? So at least when it comes to the second and the third T20, you thought South Africa were also in with a chance. They were not completely out of it. But then, first of all, the chase, so 164 in the second T20I on a Durban pitch is sort of slightly, maybe just under par, because that's a fast pitch and the outfield is lightning fast.
Yeah.
You think there's a lot of runs to be had, 180, maybe he's on par, but South Africa, you never write them off. But then,
No.
You think Mitchell Marsh coming in at 3 is a revelation apart from his captaincy?
Oh, he's had an incredible run, hasn't he? Yeah. So once out so far, is that right?
No, for now, they won the T20 series 3-0.
Yeah.
And they won the first ODI. So when you look at Mitchell Marsh, I think he got given this captaincy for this whole tour.
That's right.
It was an experimental thing, and he got given new players like Matthew Short and the other thing, other people we've already discussed. So usually Matthew Wade or somebody like that would get given the captaincy previously. Now they thought, you know what, let's send this guy in. Let's see what he can do as a captain. And I mean, he's been around the Australian setup for donkeys, yes, but he's only 31.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
So he still has good 3-4 years, maybe another World Cup cycle left in him if his body can hold up. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe it's a good experiment from Australia. But you were saying?
I think it is. And it's particularly worked for him and his form, and the team have followed suit as well. So, and it's funny because he looks older than 31 as well, and he seems to have been around forever. So in my head, he's 33, 34, but obviously I haven't done the maths on that. So it does make a lot of sense to give him this run of games and see how he's reacted. And you have to say he's reacted brilliantly so far, and the team have followed him.
Absolutely. And I think he did very well to impress his style of play, or his sort of attitude on how he wants the team to play on these very new people. People like Spencer Johnson, Tanvir Sangha, Matthew Short, they're all T20 products. They're all BBL products. And Josh English to an extent, right? And Tim David, I think Tim David put up such a good performance. He was included in the ODI squad right away.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Almost like an audition for the World Cup, so to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a good way of using it, isn't it? That's right. It's a perfect opportunity. And they grasped it well.
Do you think now the Australian team is also going to play differently in T20s if this guy were to continue as captain, because he's taken a 3-0 victory in his first series?
Yeah. I think, well, it's funny, you can never tell. The Australians always, for me anyway, being English, I suppose antagonism with the Australians, that they always seem to come up with the goods when the pressure is on. And I think actually this would have been a good little learning with quite a different looking side against South Africa. It's maybe given the selectors a bit of a minor headache, shall we say, looking at the World Cup, exactly how they're going to play it. Interesting that Labuschagne got some runs again, didn't he? Got 80 the other day. So, much like we say about India, the Australians, I just always think, by hook or by crook, they'll always be in the mix, regardless of how they play. And it was interesting, the test series, obviously completely different, but they radically changed their very naturally aggressive approach and became very defensive against England. And the first few tests, that certainly worked for them. So it proved to me their adaptability, that they did cop a bit of flack from people viewing them as being a bit defensive, being on the back foot. But I just viewed that as a very sensible game management to get them what they needed, which is ultimately a win. And I think they'll take that pragmatic approach through to the World Cup as well.
I think so. And now the way he's played, I think he's going to be number three, no matter which format, limited overs format at least.
Right? Yeah.
With Marsh, and also, of course, Head came good in the third T20I. He won the game for them with a 92, right? It was going to be a tough chase. That one, I thought South Africa may yet pull back. So there, I think, you know, the inconsistency and the inexperience that they have in their bowling attack let them down. First of all, sort of belatedly, Tristan Stubbs scored some runs. They had Donovan Ferreira, another very exciting name in the squad. He scored some runs. And 190 is now a serious target. But then, I don't know. They had Lizard Williams and they had Bjorn Fortuyn, and Lungi Engidi got targeted in his only over. Keshav Maharaj got targeted. So I think they may have felt a bit let down by their spinners in that game, where they expected the spinners to play a bit of a role during the sort of middle overs between over number 6 and 14.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment, isn't it? Yeah, they needed more control at that point, and it wasn't forthcoming for them.
Because Josh Inglis played that aggressor role while Travis Head waited, and then Marcus Toynis did that while then Travis Head sort of took off.
Yeah. Absolutely. Again, but that's great game management, isn't it? To just let one player have his head, but the other one takes it steady. Yeah, just checking there, Josh English. Yeah, 42 off 22 balls, wasn't it? Which is just what you need in that position in the batting order.
Exactly. So, I mean, he did it well enough that we're going to discuss probably these two squads before we move away from this topic. We can also look at the World Cup squads. So, coming to the ODI series, they played the first ODI today. And again, they beat, they being Australia, beat South Africa after what it looked like they were dead and buried. So it was a real, real exciting game where it was a low-scoring thriller. It was on a Bloom Foundation wicket that was sort of sticky and sort of two-paced, and balls kept low and so on. So, I mean, the headline from one of these cricketing sites is good. They say Temba 114, rest of South Africa 88.
Right.
And then the extras took them to 222. I think he played a masterclass. He remained unbeaten towards the end, strike rate of 80. And only he had Marco Jansen. One guy, only one guy kept him company for at least 10 overs. Nobody even batted more than 6 overs with him. Right?
That's true, isn't it? Yes. Yeah. Just looking at the scorecard now.
And this
guy
carries the bat. And 222 on such a pitch is not, you won't dismiss it. You won't scoff at it. Right? And their bowlers did enough. So Australia were in like a lot of strife because one guy got retired out and five others got dismissed. And at 5 for 72, anything could have happened. And so that's when sort of the replacement, Marnus Labuschagne, stepped in for Cameron Green.
Yeah.
And he played a blinder. So Sean Abbott did a little bit of damage control. Stoinis was going okay. But then once Stoinis goes out, 6 for 93, you're like, maybe, you know,
big trouble.
You have three people really, really keen and bowling fast. They don't mind the runs. So it's Rabada, Engidi, and Kuche, the new fast bowler, the youngster. And Marco Jansen was doing sort of his bit. He was bowling one or two unplayable balls every over, right? So you thought it's not going to go the distance. If Australia bat any amount of time, they're going to win it because the run rate is never going to be in the picture. The run rate was 3 already by the 10th or 12th.
Absolutely.
So then, you know, I mean, the required run rate. So then, you know, can somebody hang in there? So it took somebody of a test match temperament to win the game. Marnus Labuschagne.
Yeah, that's right. He was the perfect man for that situation, wasn't he? Yeah.
I mean, short of Smith walking in, I think he was the absolute right man. Right?
that's right.
And you think this guy, he had a point to prove. He was left out of the squad and he's like, how dare you leave me out of the World Cup squad? I'm going to show you what you missed. And you see there's still a role for a banker. What you're saying, the longer the game, the more chances that you can actually bounce back by absorbing a little bit of pressure, staying out there, making the game, you know, sort of slowly turning it around.
Absolutely. Sometimes you do need to stabilize it for 5 overs, which seems like a long time in the one day. But in the 50-over game, you can do that. And you've got someone like him with his wealth of experience and his confidence in scoring gradually, then absolutely the perfect man. So, again, so maybe given that the Aussie select is a bit of a headache, because I think he's proved his worth in that game, isn't he?
I dare say in the coming games, so in this game, we saw Josh Inglis play as a batter, right? And David Warner came back into the 11. So there were big hitters from both sides who didn't do much. So you had David Miller, Henry Klassen from South Africa, all of these guys came in, right? So they'll be all raring to go. They'll all want to put their best foot forward.
Mm.
So also, Popeye Stoinis hasn't had much to do with the bat. He'll want one defining innings, right? Like the T20 side.
So let's
quickly look at the World Cup squads of these two teams, because we've talked a lot. So when you look at South Africa squad to begin with, Temba Bavuma is the captain. I think he's an inspirational leader, and occasionally he pulls out these performances which you cannot account for at all. I think he did it multiple times. In a test, he made 172 in a very low-scoring game, I remember recently. He's done this multiple times where, I think in a ODI recently, he hit a 150-odd, where again, he took his team nearly to a win in an improbable game. So he's the right sort of a captain. He knows how to lead from the front, but also I think he inspires certain amount of confidence and certain amount of belief in his players. When you look at the South African squad, solid middle-order options, Heinrich Klassen, David Miller, Reza Hendricks, Rasi van der Dusen, Aiden Makram, solid. Good fast bowling attack, Kagiso Rabada, Lungi Engidi, Heinrich Norkia, Sisanda Magala, Gerald Kuche. For me, the real talking point, and of course, we can't forget a guy like Quinton de Kock. He opens and Reza Hendricks will be at the top. Right? So you'll see they have only two full-time spinners, Tabrez Shamsi and Kesho Maharaj.
Mm.
No Bjorn Fortuyn, no other people. Right? I'm very surprised.
Yes.
The only other spinner they can count on is probably a starter in the squad, Aiden Makram. I think his spin has improved quite a lot. We can give him credit for
that. Okay. Yeah.
But
yeah,
have they sort of shorted themselves by not picking another full-time spinner here?
It's a huge gamble, isn't it? I think definitely, because that they are leaving them exposed, especially with the tournament being where it is. You think they'd want the backup of another one there. Puts a lot of pressure on the medium pacers and the pace attack, doesn't it? And we'll have to see what happens. But it feels like a risk, definitely. Obviously, they're back in there. There are other bowlers to produce it and those spinners to do the goods. But what if someone gets, you know, gets injured, you fall out of form, that they're really on the back foot straight away, right, aren't they?
So in these sort of conditions, you expect spinners to actually win you games. So you may even expect four spinners sometimes in the 11. I think recently in the last game, somebody was counting them. Pakistan had 5, of which 2 were all-rounders.
Yes.
So anyway, coming back, they also saw, for example, like, I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, Delhi did really well, banking on Heinrich Norkia and Kagiso Rabada, the South African opening attack. They banked on them for T20s, and they did well. But
right.
I think that's the difference between a T20 and a 50-over game, where...
It's a very different game, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Because, as we've mentioned a couple of times, the longer format does give teams the ability. Actually, you can see out certain bowlers, can't you? You can just say, we're not going to take any chances here. Yeah. Whereas in the T20, you don't have that luxury. So, yeah, it's just a very different format. And you need more flexibility in your outlook, I think.
Indeed. So that took me a little bit by surprise. But then when you come to the Australian squad, well, theirs is a different sort of a gamble, I must say. So, Pat Cummins is the captain. You have Sean Abbott, Eston Agar, right? And then you have a bunch of all-rounders, Cameron Green. You have Glenn Maxwell, Mitchell Marsh, Marcus Stoinis, right? Again, Adam Zampa is their lead spinner, Noah Sangha. And they also have 2 full-time spinners in Adam Zampa and Eston Agar. But then... the quality of their backup spin is quite good. Glenn Maxwell will most definitely be a starter. Travis Head can bowl, we know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with the likes of Marcus Stoinis, see, he's a very adaptable bowler. Unlike Lungi Ngidi, who can't bat as well as Marcus Stoinis, I must say, or Marco Jansen, who also cannot. Marcus Stoinis can open the bowling or bowl in the middle overs. He can up the batting order or come in late in the batting order. So, the same with Glenn Maxwell. You could open the bowling with Glenn Maxwell, you know. So, I think Aidan Makram did it a couple of times. But that's the point. I still think they could have chosen one more spinner. Simply because it's a World Cup played in India. Unless they planned to bowl Stephen Smith. I don't know how much he's training. Right? We don't know.
Yes, be interesting. Yeah, right?
He is a leg break bowler.
Could do. He does bowl it. Yes, I think it would be a stretch to put him in that sort of pressure cooker environment of a World Cup game. But why not?
Exactly. But let's see. I think both these teams are, for me, one spinner short. Because, look, you have a very competent base bowling attack. Pat Cummins, Sean Abbott, Josh Hazlewood. And then these are full bowlers, Mitchell Starc.
Absolutely. Right?
Are enough to win you a game. Then you have all-rounders like Mitchell Marsh, Marcus Stoinis, right? Cameron Green. So that's a fantastic, but I would have included one spinning all-rounder, but nobody has that luxury that they don't have a Jadeja. Right?
No, you don't.
Tanvir Sangha, they probably tried to see what he can do. Tim David again, who can actually bowl a bit as well, right? He didn't make it. So, but I still think there is also another question when it comes to Australia. It's about the injured people that are still actually sort of on the sidelines. People like Pat Cummins, Stephen Smith, Mitchell Starc, Glenn Maxwell.
Yeah.
So, what you said, right? Glenn Maxwell is your definite starter. And potentially, Stephen Smith, I would start. Josh English sort of would be his backup for me. So, I would always start with Stephen Smith because of his lot of banking ability, right? Go and score at a strike rate of 85 or 90 and score like bat 40 overs of the game or whatever, right? I don't know. That could be an issue.
Yeah.
Maybe they may get a late replacement.
It could be. Yeah.
Matthew Short.
Yeah, that's right. But I think that they'll be confident with the bat in front, actually with the form we've seen, as we said earlier, from Mitchell Marsh and Travis Head recently as well in South Africa. And the conundrum of David Warner as well. Obviously, he didn't have the best time over here in the summer. But
you don't write him off when it comes to World Cups. Especially he's played so many seasons of IPL, probably nobody knows India as well as David Warner, frankly.
Absolutely, yeah. Massive experience, yeah. So, it's an interesting selection, definitely.
So, I see some chinks in those squads, but it's not a write-off. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Now, if you were to quickly take a look at the other T20 series, England, New Zealand. So, England, from a 2-0, they gave the series a 2-all to New Zealand. I would say, surprised that New Zealand were able to come back in the third and the fourth T20A at all?
I think so, yeah. I think maybe it was a bit of overconfidence. Everybody that I came into contact with seemed to have written New Zealand off and thought it was going to be a whitewash in the series. But actually, you know, New Zealand have some incredibly dangerous bats. I mean, we see Glenn Phillips here playing for Gloucester in the past, and as he did in, I think it was the third game, Glenn Phillips can take an apart. Well, I like the way he plays, actually, Glenn Phillips, because he's another one. He sort of builds his way into an innings. He doesn't normally go gung-ho from the start. But if Glenn Phillips gets in and he's got his 30 off 40 balls or something, the odds on, he's going to get a big score very quickly at the end of the innings. And New Zealand have that capability within them, with the openers as well, but that they can score runs. And I think maybe England were a little blasé, and maybe being a bit dismissive of their attitude, but you can't write New Zealand off. But to come back from 2-0 down is a great achievement from their perspective.
First of all, in that 30-28, they made 200 plus. So Glenn Phillips, Tim Seifert, Finn Allen came good. And it looks like Finn Allen was sort of giving an audition for a potential World Cup opening slot as well. People like Mark Chapman, we were talking of spin bowling all-rounders. Here's a chap who can do that for you, come Asian conditions. Mark Chapman, Mitchell Santner, right? You have the strength. And Glenn Phillips, I've seen him bowl some right arm off break as well. So England, I think they were also cycling through the squad. Luke Wood played a few games. Gus Atkinson, Chris Jordan came for the third game. Adil Rashid played.
Yeah.
And then for the last game, they also had Rehan Ahmed England. So they're also running through a few options and permutations in the squad. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
And David Malan is usually a banker for England in the top order. Harry Brook, the new man, sensational guy. Will Jacks didn't distinguish himself much. And he couldn't get much bowling either, right? And then in that game, they got really found out. So the much wanted depth of English batting didn't come to four because Liam Livingstone at number seven for me is a bit late.
Yeah.
But then imagine you're four down for 55, but it's the ninth over. So you need a lot of runs. So 140 odd runs in 12 overs. If anybody can do it, it's Jos Buttler, Moeen Ali, Liam Livingstone, I would think. Except for Gus Atkinson and Adil Rashid. Adil Rashid can bat time, but he can't really hit the ball far. So you think even maybe with Chris Jordan supporting, they should have come close. So that was a comfortable loss. There, I think Kyle Jamieson really came to the fore. And Ish Sodhi, even though he went for a few runs, it doesn't matter when you're taking three wickets as a leg spinner, right? So
absolutely right. Yes, yeah, definitely.
That was a comfortable win for New Zealand. But then what surprised me was how easily England lost the last game. So Johnny Bairstow gives you a real hyper start, and then you're going at 11 plus runs on over, well into the 12th over, right? But from then on, sort of they collapsed. So from, they were not at 11 in the 12th over, but they were there in the 13th and the 14th over. But you think 105 in the 11th over, let's start there.
Yeah.
And then what happened? Well, only 175. So they would be really happy, New Zealand, that they were able to again pull back thanks to the spinners. Ish Sodhi, nobody challenged him. 2 for 21 of four.
Mitchell Santner, 3 for 30. Absolutely.
Right? So they did that really well. And Kyle Jamieson, well, he went for a few runs here. But Saudi, Matt Henry finished strong. Rachin Ravindra, another left arm spinner who can bat in the middle order, right? So New Zealand were also going through their combinations. Daryl Mitchell batted at 3. But then the main damage was done by first Tim Seifert, but then Glenn Phillips and Mark Chapman.
Yeah.
Score. They showed that maturity to take New Zealand to very close, and then Rachin Ravindra comes out, hits a couple of big shots, the match is over.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. They are very good at pacing and innings, I think, the New Zealand team. But when they've got the experience, but the explosiveness there when needed, always going to be a threat. I really like the way New Zealand play.
I mean, this England team are really good. They want to chase and they want to chase big, beat in any format, I think. They're very confident. But in games like this, when you have a 179, which is slightly above par in most cases, they are unable to come up with the goods where nobody looked to slow the game down. Rehan Ahmed did. He did really well. He took 2 wickets as well. But then Moeen Ali, as the more experienced spinner, 2.2 overs, 23. Adil Rashid, 4 overs, 41. That was a bit of a letdown for me. Also, Sam Curran.
Yeah, yeah.
So, something I think they may also want to learn when it comes to the longer format, not completely ignore that, right? Because you are good at chases, but then what happens when you end up batting first and not come up with a above par score, right?
Absolutely, and that is going to happen, isn't it? It's you have to be prepared to as we think we said before, to really squeeze teams or strangle them, and England didn't have the capability to do that.
So for me, the ODI series that starts has a lot of significance, has assumed a lot of significance with the World Cup squad sort of up for grabs. They've added Harry Brook to the squad, right?
Yes, almost by public demand, I think. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I somehow think Luke Wright has sort of made up his mind. And then I think he was persuaded by the likes of, I don't know, potentially Ben Stokes or somebody, and who was told, you know, give this guy a go, right? I mean, who would you pick him in place of? Liam Livingston, because Liam Livingston can bat and bowl.
Yeah, he can bat. I think probably Livingston would be the one to step down for me, just because, and it's not a criticism of Livingston, but just that Brook is exceptional. Mm-hmm. He's almost like one of those once in a generation players, and he's obviously doesn't succeed every time. And he got, I think, was he four in the last game? But he plays the game with such a freedom, such power for a slight guy. He's tall, but he's not powerfully built necessarily. And he just is that maverick card in that batting order there that can absolutely destroy a team. And I think Livingston, probably for me, would be the one to step aside, but it's a tough call because he hasn't done a lot wrong, Liam Livingston.
Indeed. So again, New Zealand, you never write them off. And Liam Livingston, I don't think he got enough chances with the bat or enough time with the bat to make a point. Maybe only in the third and the second T20 he had some time. But let's see. Let's see how that goes, because we can also expect Liam Livingston to fight a little. I mean, when you look at the squads.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right? He's also there as a bunch in the bunch of all-rounders. But for me, if you were to look at spinners in Asian conditions, Moeen Ali and Adil Rashid would be my first picks.
Definitely. I mean, those have got to be in to start with, yes. And their wealth of experience.
Simply because there's one guy who's in the ODI squad called Joe Root, who can bowl. Who can bowl more than handy off-breaks, right?
He's a menace, actually, Joe Root.
So definitely. With Joe Root in that squad, that's why I think Liam Livingston might miss out, because you will want to have Joe Root as your banker, English banker, much like, you know, Stephen Smith and so on. So that's going to be very interesting. They'll miss the firepower of the likes of Archer, for sure. But then Braden Carr has been given a chance. Gus Atkinson is still in the ODI squad. You have the likes of Reece Topley, who's not very rapid, but has enough pace. You have Mark Wood. Of course, you can never write this guy off. I think he's going to, potentially he's closer to the end, Mark Wood, 33 plus. Maybe this World Cup, maybe one more World Cup, T20 World Cup. We don't know. That's why we recently heard he turned down he might turn down a full-time England contract to try and play in T20 league starting next year already. So
That sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
So plenty to look forward to. Neither of these teams have picked a squad, but we know New Zealand sort of are more or less certain to pick Kane Williamson in their squad. Their banker,
talisman.
You would think he would play, and he would be the first name on the sheet or the second name on the sheet in most games. But then they also have quite a lot of people to sort of sort out from what we saw in the T20s and 50-over cricket games.
They do rotate their teams a lot, don't they, New Zealand? So they and that's one thing that maybe I think works against them, because there's almost 20 people there for New Zealand that could come in and do a job, and you wonder if they've really got a coherent plan sometimes to get the best team on the pitch for that particular game.
Look, you'll have Saudi Bolt potentially playing for the last time together in any world tournament, I think. They'll want to do something special. They're a really special pair. Beat the red ball or the white ball, right? You have the likes of Daryl Mitchell, very experienced now. You have Glenn Phillips, more or less running the middle order, right? But then you also have sort of people like Jameson, who's sort of come back and wants to re-establish himself as a preeminent all-rounder. You have spinners like Santner, all of these people, right? So it's going to be real, real fun. So I'm looking forward to their squad as well, the New Zealand squad.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so definitely. Now if we were to have a quick look at the women's cricket.
And sensational performance by Sri Lanka against England.
Absolutely. Let's start right there. So surprised. So Sri Lanka, who had never won a game against England on English soil, come back and win two T20Is to take the series. Surprise?
Yeah, remarkable. Obviously, there've been a few changes in the England setup, and I'll be absolutely honest, I don't know enough about the Sri Lankan ladies team to know if they were absolutely at full strength or whether they'd made a few changes. But can't take away what they did. Both, tremendous performances, weren't they?
So if you look at Samari Attapattu, really the talisman when it comes to Sri Lankan women's cricket, both with the bat and ball, she opened the bowling and she opened the batting. But then in the two decisive games, what really mattered was Sri Lanka chased. They restricted England to 101, under 120. First game 104, second game 116, 17. That's their range. The moment England would cross 150, they would be in trouble, Sri Lanka. They knew it. You look at their bowling attack, still very much spin dominated, and that worked for them here in foreign conditions, right? So you play with your with your strength. I mean, as an Indian fan going back, India bowled three or four spinners against England in that 1971 series. I don't know if you remember. They won it, right? So why not?
Yeah.
Go by your strength and play your type of cricket. Forget what the opposition brings. Yeah. Like pretty much what South Africa does wherever they go. Bring a lot of firepower, a lot of artillery, try and blast the batsman out, right? That worked for Sri Lanka. And then Chamari Attapattu also with the ball. Also with the bat. Of course, she's one of the preeminent hitters in women's cricket, frankly. Much like in the mold of very illustrious male cricketers like Jayasurya. A top order, like a thrasher who can kill the game off in 5 to 8 overs. Right? That's what she did in that first, in the second T20. They won the second game, surprised everybody. But then England, they had sort of more or less the sort of squad they wanted. Mahika Gaur played in the decisive game, but they had Freya Kemp, they had Heather Knight, they had all the big names, they had good spin options themselves, right? They were kept to 116 all out. Lot of good bowling, Chamari Attapattu taking a 3-4 and then coming out and hitting 44 in no time. That's it. The game was killed.
And 3 for 21, wasn't it? So very tight, very controlled, and they just, well, again, what I like about it seems a real team spirit and team effort there to strangle the England batting and then bat powerfully from the top and chase the target down comfortably in the end.
Exactly. So the England team will be hurting. This is the team that came back to hold Australia for a share of the ashes, right? And from there, they may think, we've let ourselves down badly. So I'm really looking forward to the ODI series that follows. And I expect England to come out and thrash Sri Lanka. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, I think there'll be a renewed determination. And it's interesting because John Lewis, who is the coach of the ladies team, is a former Gloucestershire man here. And actually, we had a lovely session with John Lewis a while ago, just before he took the job. And I know he's very determined that they will produce the goods, and was thrilled with the way they came back against Australia. And I think that he'll be disappointed with what happened, but also it will have given him an insight into a few other players, and they'll view it as a positive learning curve, I'm sure, and look to really drive home some big victories going forward from here.
That's going to be very interesting. I'm looking forward to that series as well. And the other series, really, the one where, frankly, Pakistan beating anybody at home is not that much of a surprise. They're a very strong team.
So
you have Bisma Maruf, Nidadar, and people like real Diana Beg, Nashra Sandhu. These are all real stalwarts when it comes to the game itself. And so no surprises there. They blanked South Africa 3-0. And South Africa were without many of their key players. So Laura Walwart was made the skipper. Sunilu stepped down. There were some internal things going on there. Probably it also reflects on the result.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's how it came out. And that's why you saw they were not as good as they could have been.
Okay. I wasn't aware of that. So that's interesting to hear a bit of the backstory. Yeah. All I really saw on that was that it was the whitewash victory. So but Pakistan is strong, like you say.
Absolutely. And they didn't have a couple of their top players.
Right, yeah.
Chloe Trion didn't go. They didn't have their best pick of players, it must be said. But then also they're playing away from home in unfamiliar conditions where spin probably dominates.
Yeah.
But then, 150 plays, 144 is not particularly low scoring if you're looking at women's T20s. So
Pakistan. Absolutely, yeah.
Right? Pakistan came out on top and deservedly so. So wonderful result there if you're a Pakistani cricket fan.
Just by 6 runs. Yeah, but conditions would obviously suit them, and especially say with a slightly diminished South African squad.
No, for sure, because you can see that, you know, especially all T20s, more or less, Pakistan ended up making 150. So when you look at that in the bigger picture, if you end up making 150 in women's T20s, more or less certain you will be also, you know, looking to be very close to a winner that way.
Yeah, definitely.
So yes. Sune Luz probably didn't really put up her best performances. You thought she could have done more. And there are a bunch of these things that are going on the side. And I mean, we'll let the off-field issues sort themselves out. While we wish,
indeed, yes. Yeah,
we wish if possible, South Africa can put their best team on field at all conditions. It sometimes comes to pass that it might not happen. So
yeah, and that's what you just hope for all these players, isn't it? They get the opportunity to fulfil their undoubted talent, and you don't want internal politics to get in the way, really.
Indeed, let's see how that goes. They also have ODI series to follow, so something to look forward to if you're a women's cricket fan.
Yeah. Now, definitely.
We discussed a couple of World Cup squads. I think there are a couple more that we can quickly go through.
Mm-hmm.
One, India have released their World Cup squad. And when you look at this India squad, did you see anybody else making it? So India put up a really strong squad, must be said. You may think, you know, one or two players might be unlucky. People like Ashwin always come into discussions, I think, when playing at home. But then he's not been in the ODI squad sort of almost more than 12-15 months. So that's sort of on track. They didn't pick him. People like Akshar Patel will always pip Ashwin simply because of, one, the fitness in the field, also the big hitting ability, right?
Yes.
Ashwin can win you a game outright just with a ball, but then in the limited overs game where you don't need to get everybody out, you can tie them down. Akshar Patel is equally good. On the other hand, you have a stalwart in Javindra Jadeja who can both tie them down and get them out, the spinners. And I was happy to see Kuldeep Yadav make the squad, though I was a bit disappointed there was no room for Yuzvendra Chahal. I mean, Yuzvendra Chahal versus Akshar Patel is always a long debate, simply because would you want another variety bowler, somebody who can turn the ball both ways versus somebody who sort of hangs it there or thereabouts at a certain speed, right? Especially when playing Asian teams, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Afghanistan, right, even Bangladesh, they are going to be good at playing spinners.
Yes.
Akshar Patel's variety of spin is sharp on a good length, left arm, orthodox spin. He's more relying on the variety from the pitch. Then he might not be as effective as Yuzvendra Chahal or Ashwin. That's the argument, right?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So, but then they went for him simply because I think he also gives you that additional depth with the bat. Because as we always joke, India, if you have Bumrah, Shami and Siraj as your fast bowlers, you'd be a bit worried about...
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? So...
tremendous, yeah.
As well as they are with the ball, as well they bowl with the ball, you know they can't probably muster 30 runs between them when faced with a Harris Rauf or a Shaheen Shah Afridi. That's what I meant.
No.
Right?
Yeah, oh, I see. Yeah, absolutely. So yes.
That's the worry. Or a Pat Cummins, or a Mark Wood, right? You want somebody who can stand up to them as well. So that's where I think Akshar Patel pipped somebody like Yuzvendra Chahal. But then Shardul Thakur has been picked. That's another discussion point for me. Because, he's not as effective because he's a fast bowling all-rounder who's always a bit on the costlier side. In home conditions. In away conditions, he'll be your seeming all-rounder because Hardik Pandya is already in the squad. He'll definitely give you 4 or 5 overs. That's not a problem, right?
Yeah.
So then it's such a tough pick. I would think Shardul Thakur has been picked as a backup for somebody like Pandya because Pandya may not play all the games, even though he's the vice captain.
That's true, yeah.
Right?
Probably won't, I would have thought, yeah.
And same for between Bumrah and Shami, I don't think they'll play every game. So you may expect Bumrah Siraj to start and then you would have Shardul with Pandya. Right, because Pandya can win you a game just with the bat. So then you have the third bowler's contingent covered. Then you have Kuldeep and Akshar, or Kuldeep, Ravindra Jadeja and Akshar. So there are some permutations you can work out. But then last comes the most important question. So they picked Suryakumar Yadav, who's not the most, let's say, accomplished in ODIs in the last couple of months. But then KL Rahul.
Yeah,
this is the real white elephant or elephant in the room, whatever you want to call him. Poor guy, he's done nothing. He's not had a chance to come on the field, and a lot of the focus, mostly negative, has been on him. Do you have any thoughts at all on this?
To be honest, I don't know enough about his situation, to be frank with you. I don't want to talk about stuff I'm not sort of solid on. So I probably would just pass on that one.
So it's very simple, right? He's in the Asia Cup squad, but he's not yet played a game because he's not yet fit.
Right.
So I think if he plays, it'll be his first game will be India-Pakistan.
Over
the weekend. Then the next question, if he comes into the squad, what happens to Ishan Kishan, who did such a good job, at least against Pakistan, if you remember?
Yes,
he didn't get a bat against Nepal. That's not his fault. But then Shreyas Iyer is coming back. So is KL Rahul. Both are coming back from injury. They have not had enough game time. Ideally, they are competing with each other if you don't want to keep Ishan Kishan out of the squad. He's a left-hander who bats in the middle order. You need one of those at least. Rohit Sharma right-handed, Shubman Gill right-handed, Virat Kohli right-handed, Shreyas Iyer right-handed, Surya Kumar Yadav right-handed. You see the problem? Who do you pick?
Absolutely.
Ishan Kishan has to play. Then would you pick both Ishan and Rahul? Then one of Shreyas or Surya will not play.
Yeah.
You see?
It's a real conundrum, isn't it? Yeah. Exactly. And not one that I'd like to be a selector making that call, I'll be honest with you.
This is the real place where I think they may have given themselves a little bit of an issue. But then I think the team management under Rahul Dravid have some plan. And clearly you want to back your players, be it Shreyas Iyer or KL Rahul. They are sort of really good players. They have some pedigree to fall back on. Because many people thought somebody like Sanju Samson was left out. It was not right. Sanju Samson could have been picked ahead of Surya Kumar Yadav, who's really not, as I said, set the world alight. His ODI record is okayish because he's had 250s in 26 games, average of just 24. Strike rate is always good with Surya. So in this case, they were thinking, you know, maybe he can now come into his own. But they said, why not pick Sanju Samson? Why not give him the same opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
In ODIs, KL Rahul is your banker. Average 45, strike rate 87. Over 50 games, he's done his bit. That's not a problem. You will want to pick
him.
Right? Yeah. Then comes his comparison with somebody like Surya. As then you know he's better than Surya, you would think, even though he's not played much. And the other guy who's coming back from injury, you want to give him time. Shreyas Iyer. Again, a banker, a solid batter. And in Asian conditions, really, really good. Not a problem.
Yes, playing at home. Yes, yeah.
There are some holes here with the Indian squad. But then at the end, it's still a very competitive squad. They have all the bases covered. Five right-handers are as good as four right-handers and one left-hander, right? So at the end of the day, it's about the people who have been picked. Can they go ahead and win you the game? That's all there is to it. Right?
Yeah, that's right. And in those pressure conditions as well.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's where that's where somebody like Surya has pipped Sanju, because Sanju Samson is not known for his temperament. He's known for his wonderful stroke making, but Surya Kumar is known for his temperament under pressure. Same for Rahul, same for Iyer. Right?
Yeah.
So they've gone with that experience and that, let's say, more or less dependability.
Yeah. And as we said, it's time for India to win a competition, isn't it? So maybe this is some of the thinking is that we need stability. They've got to get over the line. And if you can have that experience head to help you with that, that may be the background thinking on it.
With Bumrah, Shami, Kuldeep Yadav and Siraj, you have enough people, and Jadeja, you never write Jadeja out. These could be your starters, right? These could be your starters in a final.
Yeah.
These five.
Definitely.
Each of them can win you a game on any day. So that is a very good, potent bowling lineup. Add a Hardik to it, who can do a bit of both. You have so then you know you have all your bases covered and potentially a good chance to win the trophy. So at home, we'll see what's possible. And likes of Rohit Sharma, Virat Kohli, last hora. They'll want to win some games by themselves with the bat. Right?
Yeah.
So plenty to look forward to if you're an Indian fan.
Yeah, and for some, it could be like the last big show for them, couldn't it? So it's they want to go out with a bang.
Absolutely. So let's see how it comes to pass. And a couple of Sri Lanka related news. First of all, Sachitra Senanayake, former spinner from Sri Lanka, has been arrested for some alleged coercion of players in trying to sort of get them into match fixing.
Yeah.
It happened in 2020.
Yeah, as I read it, so not games that he was directly involved with, but an idea that he was having conversations with people. It seems a very worrying story.
So that's a problem. And you know that, you know, this guy, he had a decent career at the top level, but also I think now he's sort of involved in the coaching setup and so on. So people who are in trustworthy positions with teams.
Yeah.
For them to come out and be addressed, 2020 is not so long ago. And this was sort of corona period, and not all eyes were on these tournaments, these sort of tournaments. You don't know what has happened, because recently we heard something about the ILT20 tournament in the UAE that was happening. Even in 2019-2020, Marlon Samuels was arrested for some similar sort of an allegation. So,
let's
wait out on this.
Yeah, see what comes to pass. But it's not the sort of story you ever like to hear about, is it?
Absolutely. But we know that, you know, right from the 1700s, there have been people who've been involved, because some people like a flutter or three. And that means it helps if you know which way the horse is going to run.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. Yes.
So, but that is one news. The other news is even more disturbing, if anything, because Sri Lankan cricket has actually suspended all board run domestic tournaments for now. Because...
Yeah, I only became aware of that today. That seems like a really staggering development to me. Is it to do because there's this confusion over the number of formats and the number of games, and some teams feel they're missing out? Yeah.
So in a country like Sri Lanka, much like sometimes Pakistan and other Asian countries, with a change in government comes a change in guard of the board.
Right.
That can mean one set of plans that were brought in may be thrown out by the other. So in 2021, the same thing happened, where Sri Lanka had a technical advisory committee headed by a certain Arvinda De Silva, who came up with two groups of 13 teams, did away with the two-tier structure. A lot of teams would compete. So in Sri Lanka, it's pretty much like the Netherlands, where it's the club structure that upholds the international cricket.
Right, yeah.
So they don't have this organized structure of county cricket or state level or regional cricket that some other teams have. Right. They have been trying to figure out what's best for them to try to keep their
keep the domestic game going and feeding then the international side. Right. Yeah.
So they're yet to work it out. But then I think this is a temporary setback because it's very far away from a potential domestic season, and the potential domestic season will start later due to the World Cup. They have a lot of time to work it out.
Right. Yeah.
And in Sri Lanka, pretty much like everywhere else in South Asia, this is a balm for all the everyday pains that people undergo. Cricket is the way they forget it.
Okay. Yeah.
You really can't see that being completely suspended for a year or two, unless it's like another corona year. You really can't see it suspended. So I expect some sort of arrangements and some sort of compromises will be arrived at in time. So this is something I'm looking forward to. And I think we will watch this space carefully. Let me put it like this.
Yeah. It's going to be, we just hope, again, for the sake of the cricketers, that they can play and the fans. That at the moment, the only ones that's losing out are the players and the fans. And you want a sustainable format to come forward.
Absolutely. So from that point, a little bit of a bad news again. We have come to know that Heath Streak, former Zimbabwean all-rounder, has passed away just short of 50 years of age.
Yeah, tragically young. Yeah.
He was fighting cancer, we know. And he couldn't make it. I mean, there was already sort of a hint at what was going on when his longtime teammate, Henry Olanga, who now lives in England, sort of released this news prematurely, because it was believed Heath Streak died a couple of days before the actual death happened. And it then came to the fans' knowledge that he was really close to the door of death. Nobody knew this. I mean, we knew he was sort of indicted in some sort of a corruption scandal.
Yeah.
And then he sort of stayed away from cricket. This is a wonderful cricketer, right? For a fast bowler, nearly 2,000 test runs, nearly 3,000 one-day runs, 200 wickets in both, 200 plus wickets in both.
Well, the greatest Zimbabwean to play the game, surely.
Potentially, just short of people like Andy Flower and Dave Horton, but right up there.
Definitely,
the top five. No doubt for me, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately, he had been staying away from cricketing circles because of certain convictions or certain things that he was involved in, we got to know. And then nobody knew what happened, because he had this advanced liver and colon cancer. Nobody knew.
That's right.
And then it was very advanced when he got he got diagnosed and there was not a lot that could be done. And unfortunately, that meant he passed away. Some of those photos that were released by his family a couple of days, taken a couple of days before his death, they are very haunting. Right. For this big, strong lad that I remember playing the game to what he looked like towards the end. I mean, I think it overtakes the best of us. No matter how you looked in your youth, towards the end, it's never going to be pretty. But then that was a haunting picture for me.
No, and as you said, it's just so dreadfully, dreadfully young, isn't it? It's a real tragedy for him. And also, maybe that stain that was over his name as well, there was never a chance to properly clear that or deal with that. And from somebody who was an incredible sports person, it's just a very sad ending.
Absolutely. I mean, the Zimbabwean setup could have used somebody like him, people like him and his experience. They could have taken them forward, maybe not immediately right away, but 3-4 years time when all the dust around is settled down. It's a real pity. Also a real fighter to see him go out like that. That doesn't give one a lot of nice feelings.
No.
So our thoughts are with his family and his kids, we understand, and his friends. So wherever he is, we wish he's at peace now.
Absolutely, Tim. And I didn't earlier, when you were speaking so nicely about Rinia, who passing away from guerrilla cricket, that's one to pass my sympathies on there as well. It's always sad when you lose someone important from the cricketing family, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, with Ravi especially, I was looking forward to going and maybe meeting him if possible. This time when I went to India, it wouldn't pass. That's a pity.
Even more poignant then. Yeah, I'm sorry for your loss as well.
It's okay.
Very sad.
Just an acquaintance, still it hits you know. He was also very young. He was not all that old. Not much older than Heathstreak, to be frank. But all right.
Yeah.
Now, a little bit of a high point to finish the episode. Netherlands have released their squad.
Yes.
So the World Cup squad. So I come from the Netherlands. We have to take a quick look at it because some joyous news. People like Colin Ackerman, Paul van Meekeren, Roelof van der Merwe have made it to the squad. There is also a bolter in the form of Sybrand Engelbrecht, a top order batsman from South Africa, who's also made it to the squad, South African born, must say.
Yeah.
Along with people like, some known names that are already in the squad. Wesley Burris is there, Colin Ackerman is there, and Sybrand Engelbrecht is there. It's nice to see.
Yeah, Colin Ackerman's been quite a menace against Gloucestershire recently when he's been playing for Leicestershire. He's scored some good runs, important runs, but against my team. So through gritted teeth, I'm wishing him well. talking about that, obviously, I've seen quite a bit of Paul van Meekeren bowling for Gloucestershire. And in the One Day Cup, he's been taking wickets. Can be a little expensive and there have been a few no balls. He struggled a bit with no balls on occasion. But he does have a knack of taking wickets. In fact, he's got picked up a bit of a nickname here. Instead of Paul van Meekeren, they call him Wickets van Takeren. So, which is quite a nice one, I think. And
that's a good one.
Yeah, and it's a big tournament for him because he had a slightly frustrating season domestically here, but he came in strongly towards the end. And wish him well. And Van der Merwe there as well, who can change a game. Roelof can, if he makes contact with the ball, he can hit it a very, very long way, as I've seen him doing for Somerset in the past. So there's some good players in that Dutch side, isn't there?
Absolutely. So Roelof van der Merwe will be, a starter in most games simply because he can bowl spin and hard-hitting middle-order bat, right?
Yeah.
You have Aryan Dutt, who can bowl spin. You have Shahriz Ahmed, right, leg break. So they have packed their squad well. And they have people like Vikram Singh, Saqib Zulfikar. Saqib Zulfikar is a spin bowling all-rounder, but Vikram Singh is a seam bowling all-rounder. You have enough options apart from your top bowlers like Bastel Lida, Paul van Meekeren, potentially somebody like Ryan Klein can start. Mm-hmm. So whom we really miss is the likes of Fred Klaassen. Really, he would have been a match winner, I think.
Yeah.
He's out injured, we hear. He's had a stress fracture. He's really not recovered. And also somebody like Vivian Kingma. Vivian Kingma is a bit tough, really, because he's not very consistent, but he's a good, really good bowler on his day.
Right.
He can run through sides.
Yeah.
So, and you also have the stability and the solidity of the skipper, Scott Edwards, Colin Ackerman, the experience, right?
Yeah.
You have the excitement that Max O'Dowd and Vikram Singh can bring right at the top of the order. This is a very solid squad, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And Logan van Beek is a popular player as well. I know.
Exactly.
So, there's potential there, definitely.
So I'm thinking, right, they're already going there earlier. They're doing some spin camps in Bangalore. They're looking for some Nets bowlers for them to join them and so on. They're doing all the right things and well ahead of time. Very much Dutch, to be frank with you, that they go well prepared.
That's good,
So we really hope they can come up with one or two stunning results.
Yeah.
Even though they're playing away from home. You never write the Dutch team off. So we wish the Dutch team all the best in this World Cup.
Absolutely. They've got some exciting players there, and on their day, if it clicks, they can be a handful. No doubt about that. And I think the tournament needs that, in my opinion. You do need, shall we say, and they're not being dismissive, the slightly unexpected teams to really put the big boys under pressure. And let's see what they're made of.
Okay. Those were all the news stories that I wanted to cover in this episode. It's been a wonderful chat. It's gone on a bit longer than I had feared. And as I told you, we had too many news stories to cover. So unfortunately, it went on longer. But I really thank you for your patience. Yeah. And I never felt that the chat really went on this long. So thank you very much.
It's been lovely talking with you, Ajay. It's been a nice experience. First one of these that I've done. So thank you for guiding me through it.
No worries. I think you were very patient with me. Let me rant on for a bit. But coming back, maybe we'll have you feature on another episode sometime in the future. We'll see if we can work it out with time.
Lovely.
Thank you very much once again. And we wish all our listeners a good day, wherever they may be listening from. Do follow our listeners' blog. He writes it very, very poignantly. And especially if you are used to, you know, sort of a nostalgic view on cricket. Hard stats-driven one, but a purely nostalgic one, where you also look at it just as a pure pastime, rather than, you know, looking at it as something very much like people who these days, you know, make predictions and try to earn from it and so on. Your blog is wonderful. So I really like it myself. So I recommend it to all our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ajit. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.